This is case number 64504. Ms. Campos Mercado on behalf of the petitioner and Mr. Wiggins on behalf of the real party in interest, in this case the respondent. Parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Ellis Campos Mercado of Lemons, Grundy and Eisenberg, representing petitioner Richard Schultz, and I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. So the relief that we are seeking from this original petition for writ of mandamus or prohibition is to vacate the findings of contempt and the order of sanctions issued by the Second Judicial District Court Family Division. And the basis for our relief is found in the very order that is under review with this court. On the jurisdictional issue, the order was entered. It was preceded by a non-pro-tunc order, and that's at volume 3 of the appendix at 569, where the court says, to the extent the minute order recorded after December 12, 2006 hearing is not a final order, it is now ordered that this court assumes jurisdiction of the Priest Family 1994 Trust, non-pro-tunc to December 12, 2006. And we submit that the entry of that non-pro-tunc order was improper. So the finding of contempt is based on a retroactive application or the retroactive exercise of jurisdiction over the Priest Family Trust. And it was improper because, as the court itself noted, a non-pro-tunc order may be made to make the record speak the truth concerning the acts done. In this case, that's not what happened. What happened is that in 2006, Judge Hardy of the Family Division had indicated that he was exercising jurisdiction over the issues that were then before him, and that's in the December 29th order. And in order for Judge Walker to come in and exercise jurisdiction and impose sanctions on Mr. Schultz, he employed the non-pro-tunc order to supply information, which is an improper basis for using the non-pro-tunc doctrine. It wasn't just to clarify, but it was to supplement an order, and that would have been improper. In the years before that contempt order was issued, Mr. Schultz was authorized by law to administer the trust without court intervention or approval under NRS 164.015. So the next thing that the court does once it assumes jurisdiction based on this non-pro-tunc order is it goes ahead and defines what contempt is. And on page 567 of the record, volume 3, the court defines contempt under NRS 22010, which is the civil contempt statute, not the criminal contempt statute. And he defines it as disobedience or resistance to any lawful writ, order, rule, or process issued by the court or judge at chambers. And this is the important part. Any order intended to be the subject of contempt must be clear, unambiguous, and must spell out the details of compliance by clear, specific, an unambiguous term so that the person will readily know exactly what duties or obligations are imposed on him. Recognizing that that's the standard, then the district court turns around and says basically the one order that he found was violated was the April 2007 order based on the reporting requirement and a budget not being submitted within 90 days, although that's not entirely clear. But then with regard to the aiding and abetting, on page 576 of the record, Judge Walker goes on to say, this author can find no clear manifest violation of trust duties and responsibilities recorded as an explicit order of this court for the purpose of finding contempt, other than those expressly related to the reporting discussed above. So recognizing that there's a provision for finding contempt and recognizing that he doesn't have that provision, he creates this thing called aiding and abetting. So essentially what Judge Walker does is he charges Mr. Schultz with aiding and abetting, he convicts him of aiding and abetting, and he sentences him for aiding and abetting, all under a standard of clear and convincing evidence, which of course he's made perfectly clear throughout this record that he is charging Richard Schultz with criminal contempt. That finding alone renders this order constitutionally infirm and void, because due process requires somebody to be charged, who is being charged criminally, to be found guilty on proof beyond a reasonable doubt. not clear and convincing evidence. And again, the fact that he finds clear and convincing evidence is right in that very order that is under review today.
To what extent does paragraph 12 of the December 29, 2006 order obviate the need for the nunk-pro-tunk aspect of the contempt order,
No, I don't, if at all? I don't believe that it does, because Judge Hardy starts that same paragraph with this dispute, and that's the disputed issue. One of the things that they were talking about at that time was whether or not the guardian should get a certain amount of money, and this was before the April 2007 order. So also, during the contempt proceedings, Mr. Schultz testified under oath what was being discussed during that time when Judge Hardy entered this order, and that was specific to the appointment of a trustee and the budget issue. It had nothing to do with anything else that Judge Walker found Richard Schultz in contempt for. So, and I think that Judge Walker also recognized, because Judge Walker had this order, and I think he recognized that this did not give him the jurisdiction that he needed to find contempt sanctions, because otherwise he would not have entered a nunk-pro-tunk order. And that would be the only reason for him to enter the nunk-pro-tunk orders. He knew he did not have jurisdiction over Richard Schultz. And if he didn't have jurisdiction, then this order is void. Aside from the fact
so unlike us, we didn't get this copy of this order until Priest filed a motion for leave to file the appendix. And so you're saying that there was no ambiguity for Judge Walker with respect to this order, and he clearly knew he needed to augment it in order to have a predicate for contempt.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that is evident in the contempt hearings where he's questioning Richard Schultz about this very order.
Yeah.
And that's one of the paragraphs that is cited in that.
So you would say that the exercise of ancillary jurisdiction that David Hardy referred to was limited to the specific issues before the court in 2006?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And so on top of everything else, there is insufficient evidence either under a clear and convincing standard or a beyond a reasonable doubt standard to find Richard Schultz in criminal contempt of court. As indicated in the order, and as this court has said in multiple cases, you've got to look at NRS 22010 and 199340, which are the contempt statutes, to see did the contemner or alleged contemner violate any of the provisions of those statutes. And none of those has been cited. The only one that Judge Walker cited was NRS 220103, which is a violation of the court order rules processes of the court. Now, while recognizing that there has to be an explicit violation, Judge Walker listed a bunch of rules in his order, but never pointing out how these orders or rules were violated by Mr. Schultz. What he ends up doing is saying, well, he might not have violated that rule or that statute actually pertains to guardians and not trustees, but because the Supreme Court promulgated the rules or authorized the promulgation of the rules, that's an order that Richard Schultz violated. Well, that is the broadest reading of the contempt statutes that I've ever seen. And as you know, these statutes are criminal in nature. They're punishing statutes, and they have to be strictly construed. And so instead of strictly construing it, Judge Walker broadened it as much as he could in order to get sanctions on Mr. Schultz for things such as just what he says is things happen under his watch. Well, under his watch doesn't mean that he violated any orders or rules. Things that happen by the guardian, those are not things that Mr. Schultz should be found in contempt for. I mean, that would be a really sad public policy for us as lawyers to have to be held in contempt because our clients don't do what we tell them to do or they do things that are contrary to the court's orders. Whether he held the guardian in contempt is another issue, and I'm not here to defend that, but I am here to say that this order is so constitutionally infirm as to be completely void. Aside from the fact that of the jurisdiction issue, the due process issue is just alarming. I don't say this lightly, Your Honor, and this is a situation where I believe the court not only manifestly abused its discretion, I believe he abused his judicial authority. And what has been demonstrated in this record is that Judge Walker has a predisposition to find Schultz in contempt, no matter what this court might rule. One of the things that is I'm very troubled by is that he found Mr. Schultz had committed defalcations before he ever received the response to the OSC, before he ever received testimony of the OSC. Although nobody opposed the OSC, Judge Walker was not prepared to purge it. You know, Mr. Schultz submitted the accounting as he was required to. Ultimately, yes, he was late, and that was an oversight on his part. But once he did so, the consent citation should have been purged, but it was not. And when Mr. Schultz's criminal counsel said, you know, you should purge the citation now because we've complied with your OSC, Judge Walker said, no, this is between me and Schultz. I mean, that is so, it just shows a personal crusade, and unfortunately, that's what's going on even as this case is sitting on appeal here or sitting in these proceedings. One of the concerns and one of the things that we submitted with our most recent, the supplementation to the appendix, is the last hearing that we had. Judge Walker has been holding compliance hearings against Ms. Baylor, although he recognizes that there's a stay as to Mr. Schultz. It doesn't stop him from saying things or doing things that indicate to opposing counsel, go ahead and start pursuing a lawsuit against Mr. Schultz. One of the things that he says is, when or if I get jurisdiction against Mr. Schultz, then you know, he and Ms. Baylor are going to pay. And, you know, at this point, he's at $300,000, and that's in the fifth supplementation that we submitted. And I do apologize to the court. Page 23 of that, the fifth supplement was missing, and we filed that this morning. But in that, on that page, on page 23, he says, you know, I don't believe Ms. Baylor, but I don't have any evidence. And he recognizes that this is a constitutional issue, but he's not putting her under oath. And, you know, just the constitutional defects in this case are just overwhelming. And so what I would ask, if the court has the least bit of an inclination to send this case back, that it do send it back to another judge, because Judge Walker has indicated his predisposition to rule against Mr. Schultz no matter what evidence is presented before him. And unless the court has any other questions, I will reserve.
I've got one question, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Can you address the issue of Mr. Schultz as trustee aiding the guardian in removing the ward from the jurisdiction and the contempt issues surrounding that?
Yes, Your Honor. There was no aiding. Ms. Baylor had made a decision that she was going to move. Mr. Schultz, the record reflects, Mr. Schultz told her that she couldn't do it without getting the court's permission and talking to the doctors. Of course, Ms. Baylor was going to do what she was going to do, as clients will sometimes do. Now, after she left, and as she left, Mr. Schultz, as the trustee of Jim Priest, had the obligation to pay for his support. And that's what he continued to do. If he didn't pay Ms. Baylor, Jim Priest would be without a guardian. If he didn't pay for the move, Jim Priest would end up being by himself. And so those were the issues that Mr. Schultz was facing, is he had obligations under the trust to protect this ward in terms of providing for his care, providing for the guardian's fees. The selling of the house was not an aiding abetting issue. She was already gone. She had already taken the ward to Wyoming. Selling of the house was actually to preserve the trust assets. He had to sell it in order to take the money. Otherwise, it would be sitting there. And this was at a time when the economy was declining. So he sold that house, and he sold it under his statutory authority as a trustee in order to preserve the trust. So there was nothing, again, there that prohibited him by order or by statute from either selling the house or continuing to pay the trustee. When he recognized that the guardian was no longer going to be available, and basically she was no longer needed, he stopped paying her, and she filed a lawsuit against him. So he wasn't assisting her, and he wasn't working with her to get the ward out of the state. And so, I mean, that just was, again, another instance where the court changed the facts in order to bring Mr. Schultz in, recognizing apparently that Ms. Baylor is not going to be the one to replenish this trust. And it shouldn't stand on Mr. Schultz to replenish the trust because the court believe something happened that shouldn't have happened.
Well, the court was fairly harsh in its assessment of that whole situation and what he knew and what he did, especially on page 20 of the court's order. He made very specific findings. How do you reconcile that?
Are you referring to the ones on paragraph 3?
3 and 4.
So, well, he doesn't believe Mr. Schultz, but he also doesn't believe the guardian. He really doesn't have any basis for his findings that he warned his client not to move. I mean, that Mr. Schultz gave that testimony under oath. Now, Judge Walker didn't believe him, but he didn't believe her either.
I mean, when the judge uses language like this, such as Mr. Schultz did nothing to rectify the situation until events had devolved so negatively that he had little choice but to come tardy to the court and attempt to cover his tracks with half-truths and excuses. I mean, that's pretty harsh.
It is very harsh, Your Honor. And I think, unfortunately, that is part of the predisposition that Judge Walker had to find somebody in contempt, and particularly Mr. Schultz, because there's really no evidence to support that. And that's the whole thing with contempt citations. There's got to be evidence of it. There's got to be sufficient evidence. And there is no evidence other than what Mr. Schultz presented to the court. It was not opposed by anybody. Nobody brought in anything to the contrary.
But isn't the court entitled to assess the credibility of the witness that is providing that testimony? And perhaps in Judge Walker's defense, if you will, hearing the testimony that he heard, he found it to be without credibility, and therefore that informed the basis of the harsh language that we hear.
Well, I think he's entitled to disbelieve it if he's got something, a basis for disbelieving it. But there's nothing to the contrary to refute what Mr. Schultz has said.
Well, except the fact that the word is gone and the trust, some of the trust assets have been sold. I mean, that's a fact.
Well, yeah, the ward is gone because the guardian took him. Again, it wasn't a matter of getting Mr. Schultz's permission to do that. What Mr. Schultz tried to do along the way is trying to make sure that there was sufficient money to pay for the ward and to take care of him, whether he was in her care or in the home that he ultimately ended up in.
But the trustee cannot ignore legal obligations that he has both to the ward and to the trust, and to the court. And it is pretty clear, at least to me, that Mr. Schultz knew what was going on, and, in fact, as you acknowledge, funded the removal of the ward from the state without court permission. That's troubling to me.
Well, and Your Honor, and I understand that, and one of the things that is clear here also is that when he left, they were supposed to establish the guardianship in Wyoming. And so the payments, again, were made as part of his trust duties. It wasn't in violation of a court order. It wasn't in violation of any rules. And those are the issues that what we're dealing with here, is did he violate any of the rules? Did he engage in any of the contemptuous conduct in either of the statutes? And he did not. And Judge Walker really didn't have a basis for making those findings other than he just didn't believe anybody, and this is the conclusion that he reached. But one of the things that he did say is he conducted an investigation and found that there was no misappropriation or no criminal conduct on Mr. Schultz's behalf, and that's in the record as well. So having found that there was no criminal conduct or misappropriation, the findings here are extremely troubling. And I see my time is way past up. So,
And I'm going to add, because we... peppered you with questions, I'm going to add 2 minutes to your rebuttal time and two minutes to the respondent as well. Of course.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dana Dwiggins, counsel for the ward, James Priest. This is the poster child case why an attorney should not serve as a trustee in which he also serves as counsel. He wore two hats as a trustee and a counsel that created an inherent conflict of interest, one that he created and to which he should be held accountable. In that regard, it's important for this court to recognize, and I think this court does somewhat, that the contempt sanctions that were issued against him were in his capacity as a trustee, not as an attorney. The district court properly held him in criminal contempt based upon his own admissions. And when I just heard Ms. Campos refer to no evidence and that Judge Walker didn't hear or believe the credibility of Mr. Schultz's statements, it was based upon his own admissions as to what he did, and I'm going to go into those in quite a bit of detail. I think those admissions establish, beyond a reasonable doubt, that he was liable and willfully violated a clear and unambiguous order of the court that directed him to take certain actions as trustee that he admittedly did not take, and that he willfully aided and abetted the guardian in relocating the ward out of state, which she could not have done without his assistance as trustee and paying for those. Now, even though the court applied a different standard, we'd submit that it's a harmless error, Your Honor, not only under NRCP 61 and NRS 178.598, but this court's precedent as well. His rights were not substantially affected by the application of a lesser standard, and we don't believe that they could show prejudice and that the results would have been any different. Again, based upon Schultz's own admissions, he was in violation of the court orders. Now, Your Honor, there was discussion about the December 29th, 2006 order, and we did supplement our appendix to include it after briefing was complete. I think the appellant's exclusion of that order from the appendix to begin with is tantamount to a fraud on this court. I think that court explicitly assumed jurisdiction over the trust, and I reference paragraph 12 of Judge Hardy's order that states, quote, "This dispute regarding the internal trust affairs may be resolved by reference to NRS chapters 163 and 164. The attorneys ask this court to exercise ancillary jurisdiction, which it does pursuant to Borelli." If you read that order in context, it did not just assume jurisdiction for a limited purpose, as Schultz contends in the writ. It did not assume jurisdiction solely for the purposes of accepting Wells Fargo's resignation, approving their accounting, and appointing Schultz as the trustee. The express terms of the order do a lot more. And specifically, I direct the court's attention to paragraph 18 of the court's order, where the court orders that the trustee shall not increase the guardian's compensation until further order of the court. The court also orders that the trustee's budget was temporarily confirmed until further order of the court. In turn, paragraph 11 of the order, Judge Hardy expresses concern regarding the rapid rate of depletion of the trust assets, and he states that the trust expenses must be substantially and immediately reduced, and that he intends on protecting the grantor's intent. When you read that order in context, I think it's clear that it assumes jurisdiction for all purposes relating to that trust, and that it was unequivocal, and that, more importantly, that the jurisdiction of the court was going to be continuing and not terminated, as Schultz contends, on the way. Now, again, I think his omission from the record is material and tantamount to a fraud on the court. I realize that Judge Walker's issue of contempt issues a nunk-pro-tunk order based upon the minute order and the belief that an order didn't exist. And I recognize that Judge Walker, during the contempt hearing, referenced this specific order. Unfortunately, I wasn't counsel of record. I can't speculate as to why it wasn't referenced in the contempt order that was issued 7 months later, but I would submit that the nunk-pro-tunk order was not necessary at all, because the December 29th, 2000 order did everything it needed to do. And if you turn even more so to the April 24th, 2007 order, which ironically, Schultz contends was not a clear and unambiguous order as to which he could be held in contempt, but he is the author of that order. He himself drafted. And again, just the express terms of that order refute their contention that the court's jurisdiction was limited to Wells Fargo's resignation, their approval of an accounting, and Schultz's appointment as a trustee. Specifically, it orders that the trust assets be invested in a manner consistent with the investment strategy that was proposed. It further requires the trustee to submit annual accountings, and it further requires the trustee to develop and submit a budget relating to the trust and to take into account all of the ward's expenses and costs. It further approves the trustee's compensation and reimbursement of expenses subject to ratification and confirmation at an annual accounting. These orders were all consistent with the pleadings that Schultz himself filed in this matter, again demonstrating that the jurisdiction of the court was continuing and it was not limited. Now, turning to the basic...
Before you leave that order, could you... I think I heard you say that stipulation in order, the April 24th, 2007, obligated Schultz to file annual accountings. Where do you see that in that order?
It states, Your Honor, in paragraph 5, where he has appointed at trustees that his fees and reimbursement of a cost are subject to ratification
okay.
by the court at the annual accounting of trust activities.
Thank you.
Now, Your Honor, I guess one other point before I move on, and again, it goes back to their admission of that December 29th, 2006 order from the court. In their reply specifically, and I could point to several places in the writ, they infer that no order exists. In fact, I'm not even sure they infer it. Versus directly state it, that no order exists assuming jurisdiction over the trust. Specifically in their reply on page 9, I quote, they state, while Priest and the respondent court have inferred that Judge Hardy assumed jurisdiction over the Priest family 1994 trust, no order has been cited to support their inference. And again, on page 12, they state, although there is no dispute that the family court could have exercised supplemental jurisdiction over certain aspects of the trust that are related to the guardianship, there is no evidence that it actually did so. Priest's arguments must be rejected because they are based largely on what the district court could have done, not what it actually did. I would submit that that is a material misrepresentation to this court as to actually what occurred below. Turning, though, to the actual contempt that the court found, it was based upon NRS 22010 sub 3, which was the disobedience of an order, that order being the April 24th, 2007 order, as well as aiding and abetting the guardian's unlawful removal of a ward from the state under NRS 159079, and also upon NRS 159305 that allows a court to cite any person in that has assets pertaining to the ward, and under NRS 159315 that allows a court to order repayment of any money, and if they fail to do so, to hold them into contempt. Now, the court found contempt based upon, again, the order that was violated and the trustee's failure to report. That failure to report included not only failing to file the annual accountings, but failing to seek ratification and confirmation of his fees on an annual basis and failing to submit a budget. And the second basis, again, was for aiding and abetting the guardian's removal. Now, the egregious conduct that the court found that resulted in such the harsh remedies, as well as the harsh findings that Your Honor already referenced, was based upon the harm that was done to the ward in the process. When Wells Fargo was in the process of resigning, Schultz, through his representation of the guardian at the time, adamantly fought against Wells Fargo's proposal to sell the house. There were opinions of doctors that were submitted saying how detrimental it would be to the ward's health to remove him from his own home environment. And he was gainfully employed at that time, too. And he was receiving insurance through work. What happened is the ward was moved out of the state without permission. The trust assets went from almost $900,000 in value to less than $200,000 in value in 4 years, or a little over 4 years, while Schultz was serving as trustee. What happened was about 3 months after the relocation, the police were summoned to the house where the ward was found locked in a basement, completely isolated, and he was placed in a psychiatric facility for a month, where it cost the trust $25,000. After he was removed from a lockdown facility, he was not clear to go home, and he remained in a mental facility because of his health condition, both physical and mental, for 3 years at $9,000 a month. The actions were exactly what Judge Hardy sought to avoid in 2006, to protect the assets of the trust so that they were available for the ward's benefit, so that the ward was living a healthy life as much as possible. Where is the ward now? The ward doesn't have a home to live in. He lives in a group home. He's no longer employed. There's very minimal trust assets left, and he's on public assistance. That was the harm that Judge Walker found so offensive as a result of the violations of the order to hold Mr. Schultz in contempt. And again, I believe rightfully so.
Now, you reference violations of the order. As far as one of the contempts that was imposed, I don't see any indication that Mr. Schultz had any knowledge of this, and there was no statute or no court order at that time that required him to file an annual trust accounting.
I believe, and again, in response to Justice Pickering's question, that the April 24th, 2007 order did in fact require him to file an accounting. In fact, during the contempt proceeding, and I reference the appendix at 4F 685, he admitted his obligation to account pursuant to Judge Hardy's order. He also obviously acknowledged his obligation to account by the fact that he actually filed an accounting. And if you look at his billing records at 2App 322, in September of 2010, his own billing records show that he was working on an accounting of the trust. And he further admitted during the proceedings, and I reference 4App 674, which is his own testimony during the contempt proceeding, which he admitted that he didn't account. So he admitted he had the duty to under the terms of that order, and he admitted he didn't do so. I think.
And your citation for the admission of the duty to account is 4App 495?
685, I believe, Your Honor.
685? Okay. Thank you.
That is the transcript of the hearing.
Right. It seems to me, and Ms. McConnell makes the point that Judge Walker knew he needed to do a non-pro-tunk order notwithstanding the December 29th, paragraph 12 order because the jurisdiction had not been assumed as to everything to do with this trust in that December order. Could you respond to that point?
Again, Your Honor, as I previously stated, I wasn't present at the hearing, so I can't speculate as to why it wasn't included. I can tell you during the contempt hearing when Judge Walker does, in fact, reference the December 29th, 2006 order, Schultz does respond by stating that he believed it was for a limited jurisdiction. And Judge Walker responded by saying, where does it state that? Because this language doesn't seem to limit it. So again, I'm not certain as to why it didn't ultimately make it in the contempt order, except potentially it was an oversight given the fact that the findings were issued 7 months later.
Sure.
But I don't think it makes a difference because, again, I think when you look at the actual express language of the December 29th, 2006 order, I think it assumed jurisdiction. I think by its express terms, it assumed jurisdiction over the trust. It wasn't limited, and it set forth more than, again, just Wells Fargo's resignation, the approval of Wells Fargo's accounting, or the appointment of successor trustee. The court had a lot of concern regarding what the trust assets were, what money was going to be available to the ward on a going forward basis, and making sure that they were substantially reduced and minimized, the expenses were. With respect to the budget that Schultz was required to submit, he contends that he submitted a budget and therefore he didn't need to submit another budget. And the express terms of the order state he shall develop a proposed budget, so I'm not sure how he could contend that he could rely upon one that was already submitted. And in fact, the minute order from that April 3rd, 2007 hearing actually refutes his position. Because during that hearing, Judge Hardy specifically discussed the budget that was submitted to which Schultz relies on. And he states concerns regarding the fact that all of the funds are not accounted for, which I presume at that time were the employment income of the ward and his Social Security. And he directed that Schultz submit a plan or budget consistent with the discussion during the hearing. That's at 1 App 12. Therefore, it was clearly contemplated that a budget separate and apart for the one upon which Schultz relies upon was going to be, in fact, submitted. In regards to the aiding and abetting, Schultz admitted himself in a pleading that he filed in January 2012 that was referenced during the contempt hearing at 4F 702 and 703 that it was unlawful for the guardian to relocate the ward out of state to another jurisdiction. Judge Walker found that Schultz did nothing to rectify the continuing daily fraud being perpetrated on the court by his client through his offices, to say nothing to attempt or prevent or mitigate the harm to the ward and the estate which occurred. And I think, as this court already recognized, it was Schultz's actions as trustee that resulted in the aiding and abetting contempt finding. The guardian could not have moved the ward without the funds necessary, and those funds were only in the trust. It was Schultz himself that personally cut the check for the moving expenses, that personally cut the check for the rent that was paid for the ward in Wyoming. He cut the check for the guardian's fees that continued after the move, and he cut the check for the facility charges when the ward was removed from the home in Wyoming. The guardian could not have done it without him. That was the problem. He had an obligation to rectify that problem, both as a trustee to comply with the order and as an attorney of full disclosure. And I think, as Judge Walker recognized, he was authorized under his ethical obligations of 1.6B to make the disclosure to the court and to rectify the harm. If Your Honor has any additional questions?
Here's not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Briefly, Your Honor, initially I would like to take issue with the fact that I've committed a fraud on this court. We've submitted papers to this court as often as we can with what we've achieved. We're going back to 2006, and as we've gathered things, we've submitted them to the court. But certainly the court was aware through the record that we submitted that this order was out there, and it was explicitly discussed during the contempt hearings. One of the things that has been addressed is that we've misled the court into saying that this order did not exist. Again, we cite to the very order, so we're not saying that it didn't exist. Our argument has been and has always been that that order did not assume jurisdiction over the trust for all purposes. That has been what we've presented to this court all along. With regard to the issues that were brought in terms of what Richard Schultz did or didn't do, none of the things that have been identified have anything to do or fall within the ambit of either of the contempt statutes that are cited. There has been nothing to indicate that by paying the guardian under trust terms and requirements that Mr. Schultz had, that that constitutes a contempt of court. The fact that he filed a late accounting or didn't file an accounting, again, it's something that is under 22010, it would be a compliance sanction. Once he complied, that sanction should have been purged. To say that the court had authority under 159, which is the guardian statutes, to cite a person into contempt, that required an affidavit to be submitted to the court to invoke that. No such affidavit exists in this record. To say that it's harmless error for the court to use the wrong standard disregards the fact that the Constitution requires that proof beyond a reasonable doubt be presented in order to find somebody criminally liable for anything. And so that, again, the issue of he had a conflict of interest. Having a conflict of interest is not contemptuous conduct. And one of the things that Judge Walker did say in this record is that he was not holding Mr. Schultz responsible for his ethical obligations. He was there to answer to him criminally, and that's what he did. And so we'd ask the court to vacate this order as constitutionally infirm and beyond the court's jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stevens, Ms. Campos-Mercado, for your arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted. The court will take a brief recess until we return for our 11:30 argument.